God, that is a good cup of coffee, honey.
Oh, thank you, babe. Welcome to my Sunday morning culture club.
Loving it. Love our Sunday morning records.
Oh,
first up,
yes.
Are you looking a little bit troubled?
I am troubled.
What's going on?
I've been turning something over in my mind over the weekend because I haven't had much else to do, let me tell you that. First week of Jan. What is Stormzy going to do come proposal time, crunch time, with the ring, with the engagement ring for Maya? Because toxic masculinity and all that, he's going to have to out-bling Ben Simmons's massive engagement ring. But of course, I don't think he can out-bling in a sensible way, because I think Ben Simmons just has a lot more money as an NBA player versus music industry. Plus, also, it would look tacky to try and out-bling it.
I mean, it was a large ring as it was. You don't want bigger than that. No. I think it looks like it came from a Christmas cracker.
Absolutely right. And so what are you going to do? You going to make one?
He's going to have to go for something quite different. I feel he can't do the single large stone as per her previous ring, which is obviously the most popular like engagement ring style. He's going to have to do something a little bit out there, surely. A bit modern, perhaps.
Yes. Something way more thoughtful.
Can I ask what's been...
What's
triggered this terrible time mentally for you?
Yes, it's been very troubling. What has triggered it is this ridiculous tweet from this fool, who I'm not actually going to say his name because he's like a nobody on Twitter. But he has tweeted over the weekend, or I think it was on Friday, "Stormzy has gone down in my estimations for this. I don't care who the babe is. You can't go and get engaged to a next man and come to me like everything's cool, especially if that guy was richer than me. Stay over there."
Oh,
it was in response to someone posting a video of like...
the really wholesome cute video of her sitting on his lap.
Yes,
it's honestly looking adorable.
Extremely hot.
Both of them.
Yes, both of them.
And so happy.
And he looks so proud.
Oh, my heart.
But it is kind of going into this whole debate that I remember when they first got back together of like, oh, like how could you take your girl back when she's been like shagged by someone else? And like, there's this weird, horrible, toxic male belief and they're like, she's been used by another man.
Tarnished.
That's it.
It's so objectifying. It's actually crazy that people think it's acceptable in 2024 to espouse those kind of views online.
Yeah. And there've been all these men commenting like, yeah, if my babe's body count is over 3 or 5, she ain't coming.
Oh my God. Also, they are not taking into account what actually went down, as we have covered previously on this podcast.
Yeah. Yes.
And as Stormzy himself has admitted, he treated her badly. Shit went downhill because of his behaviour, not hers.
He should be so lucky.
So he's
to grace the
air. Absolutely over the moon that he's getting a second chance, rather than
absolutely
like some kind of taking an ego hit. I don't think it's an ego hit at all. I think it's a flex.
Exactly. But therefore, I am concerned over the internet reaction to the ring, because I think that's where I think people are going to do comparisons and be really mean
about
it.
There will definitely be comparisons, won't there? I mean, maybe Stormzy and Maya might keep their entire like engagement / marriage / long-term life together private.
So she might
see that. I could
never
see them
wear
having like a secret wedding. Couldn't you? Just to avoid any speculation in the first place.
Also quite nifty, isn't it? Being like, the ring's so precious, she can't wear it out. You'll never see it. It's too valuable.
It must be within 10 foot of a safe at all times.
Yeah. She's only allowed to wear it in the house with a bodyguard.
One thing I have wondered about Ben Simmons, and I went on a bit of an internet deep dive the other day, is whatever happened to Mariah Jama? The dog she had,
Little floof.
Yeah, Pomeranian. I think it must have stayed with Ben Simmons.
Because he has so many dogs.
Yeah, and he had the big curly one. And
what did she see in him? I don't know. I mean, I don't know the guy. I mean, obviously.
What the hell does she see? I mean, he's a very attractive man, but I have no idea what he's like as a person.
I know this is so judgmental and absolutely has no, there's no reason for me thinking this, but I do judge anyone who like has a collection of supermodels as exes.
I do as well. He went out with Kendall Jenner, didn't he?
What happened with the engagement ring actually? Because he was like, one of his reps was like, Maya needs to give back the engagement ring.
Yeah, there was a debate
ring
around it being returned. And then I think what her reps were like, Maya is returning the ring. She just hasn't had the chance to do so yet.
Yeah. Now that you remind me, I do have
it somewhere. I wonder how that works. Like real talk. Do you think when celebrities buy rings that are like £1 million, they get like a return policy with the jewelers? Just in case. Because how do you even return a ring like that? He's obviously going to return it. Why would you keep a diamond that's worth like crazy amounts of money like that just in your house in a safe?
I guess you don't need to necessarily return it back to the same jewelers. You could then sell it somewhere
else.
But what is the politics? Like, okay, we shouldn't even use you as an example because you are literally engaged. Say someone got engaged and then very sadly broke up before they got married.
I think you are meant to give the ring
back.
Like if the person who gave you the ring paid for it.
What if they cheated on you?
Because there are circumstances where people go and buy engagement rings together and stuff like that. It's not always the person doing the proposal buying the ring.
But if they did you dirty?
If they did you dirty, I think you can keep the ring. Surely that's one of those scenarios and where it's acceptable.
Yeah, an unspoken moral rule.
I actually rewatched Titanic on Friday night.
Interesting segue there. What's that got to do with Maren Stormzy?
Because it made me think of an expensive jewellery, because obviously Heart of the Ocean at the end.
Yes.
I think I can drop a Titanic spoiler since it's been 20 years since it came out.
So sorry about that.
You'd do something like that, wouldn't you? You might just chuck it in the ocean. I mean...
Yes.
You know.
A bit like... Andy and Good Material, just chucking all the perfume in the river.
Donny Alderton's book, Good Material, by the way, guys, if you don't know what we're referencing.
Yes, which has been our most popular episode to date. So
it has.
Clearly a
lots
success.
Of Dolly stands out here as well. And she liked the picture on Instagram, which was slightly mortifying for us guys. Real ones who have listened will know. Yeah. Because while it is flattering, it's not like the most flattering episode that could ever have been
published.
Please
only listen to half.
And I was like, Jesus Christ, if she listens to this, it's going to be extremely awkward. So I mean, hope she hasn't.
I mean, but if she has and has become a fan,
then
hello
hi, Dolly.
And welcome to our podcast.
To well, Straight Up.
Anyway, so that is the DL on Stormzy and Maya. I also know that they, I think she's moved back in with him, or they're, I've heard.
Oh, yes, because she posted with the dogs, the two big Rottweilers.
Yes.
Back in the Kingston house.
I went on such a wormhole the other day of how exactly you train a protection dog. It's fascinating. Ooh. In fact, you can't get all the info online because they don't want people training them for bad reasons. But it is very interesting.
God.
And I watched loads of videos of people in like bite suits getting dogs to like
that is a really random internet wormhole.
I don't know why, actually. But
for some reason on TikTok I keep getting served videos about American XL bullies, because you know how now they have to be muzzled.
Yes. Well, you know my party trick is a very realistic bark.
Yes, I do, actually. I've heard it. Have you done on the pod?
I don't know if this is acceptable.
Would you like to treat everyone to a quick bark?
Shall I do it from like far away?
Go on then. Oh my God, that's actually a bit scary.
Yeah, I know.
That's really realistic.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, babe. Right, guys.
I can also do a really good sheep, but I'll let that for another episode.
Save that one for next time.
Yeah.
Welcome back, honeys, as always, to Straight Up, to the second episode of January. We are the pop culture podcast, lifting the lid on all things fame, debriefing on the top books, films, TV, podcasts, music,
everything
really. Well, less music, actually, because we have realised that people are not that interested in music.
Yes, funny that.
Which is a weird one. But anyway.
And it's hosted by Kathleen and me, Ellie.
It is. Thank you for that, hon. Nearly forgot to say who we are, the usual. Right, this week we've got a big old smorgasbord of topics as per. I think, though, in keeping with the objectification conversation, it would be amiss for us not to quickly touch on the frankly bizarre 29th birthday posts that Kanye West, now known as Ye, posted in honor of his wife, Bianca Censori. Just recently, over the weekend.
Very disturbing. Top line thoughts, Kathleen, on the string of pictures. They are X-rated.
His whole feed is now just 9 photos of Bianca in various states of undress, pretty much. Well, most of them.
And what's really weird in all of them, he's basically fully clothed, and in fact, very clothed, like more clothes than usual.
So one of the pictures, guys, which I'm sure you will have all seen at the time, is from last year when the couple were photographed all around Italy wearing some very odd outfits, I suppose. I don't even know whether you can call hers an outfit. He was in a kind of like black trouser t-shirt with shoulder pads combo. Bianca was wearing what I can only describe as a sheer like nude tights kind of color. Like, is it a bodysuit? Is it tights and then a top? I don't know. But she looks naked and she's using a purple pillow cushion to cover her modesty.
Yes, it's bizarre. I mean, I think the running theme of most of Bianca's presence online recently is just her naked. Or there was one where she's just wearing a toy dog.
It is very odd and I don't like it. There's something iffy about it all, isn't there?
There's something weirdly like he's trying to present his page as a kind of like, oh, look how much I value and adore my wife. Let me dedicate my whole page to her by posting.
But actually, it's like you clearly think of her as a possession.
Yes.
Even his birthday message, I thought was really strange. So he wrote, Happy birthday to the most beautiful, super bad, iconic muse, inspirational, talented, artist master's degree in architecture, 140 IQ, loving by my side every day when half the world turned their backs on me, and the most amazing stepmom to our children. I love you so much. Thank you for sharing your life with me. I have so many thoughts.
It doesn't feel like there's much about her in that caption.
It's about him.
Yeah.
Her birthday ode is in fact about the fact that the world turned their backs on him.
Yes, and about his children.
Yes.
Well, with a bit of humble bragging about her IQ.
To our children. If I was Kim, I wouldn't love that. Not our shared children. His children with Kim.
It is giving me flashbacks to Julia Fox's staged kind of imprisoned photo shoot for, was it Ideal Face, one of those magazines.
Okay, so this is what I really wanted to get your thoughts on because there seems to be a bit of a pattern, no?
Yes. So as you will know, guys, if you listen to my Julia Fox review and
the resident
interview,
Julia Fox expert,
c'est moi, she revealed that the whole interview that, it was with Interview, the whole magazine interview that she did for Interview magazine was actually kind of ghostwritten by Kanye, even though it said it was written by Julia Fox, that she really didn't approve the copy, felt very exploited by it. And then the images of her and Kanye in the hotel room, she actually thought were private images and had no idea they were then going to be used online by Interview magazine, which was something that Kanye sorted out specifically with the editor.
Very
much against Julia's will. So that is what these pictures remind me of, like a kind of solemn looking woman, not in control of a situation, who doesn't want these images to go anywhere.
There's something very sinister about the whole thing. For one, she doesn't really seem to have any autonomy. Like we said, she has kind of, I don't want to say disappeared, but as soon as she married Kanye, her personal Instagram disappeared.
Yes.
We never hear directly from her. She seems to almost be this like mute prop. Well, in Ye's universe.
Apparently there are rules, which again does not surprise me considering what Julia Fox said, that she had to be dressed by Ye and he had to approve all her clothes, and his assistant used to have to like redress her if he didn't approve of the outfit she came to meet him in. Apparently Bianca can only wear what he decides and she's not allowed to speak in public.
That is honestly awful. I mean, she always looks super miserable in all the pictures of them together as well. Not to put words in her mouth, but she doesn't look like a happy woman in most of those photographs.
No, and sometimes, in fashion, sometimes like, you know, with the Balenciaga looks, like it's part of an aesthetic to look miserable. Particularly with Ye's clothes.
Especially if it's high fashion. There's obviously that brilliant scene in
Triangle of Sadness.
Triangle of Sadness, when they're like, H&M, Balenciaga, H&M, Balenciaga. Yes. And if it's like cheap clothes, it's all happy smiles. Whereas when it's really expensive clothing, it's like dark and
with like
brooding.
A storming war. Yeah. Which, to be fair, I mean, Ye's all black outfits are quite Balenciaga-y, aren't they? Like all big leather, masculine, military
and
stuff.
And that's not even getting into the whole Balenciaga controversy.
Oh my god, yeah.
Lots of people still boycott them post their like essentially like child abuse inspired shoot. Very odd.
So it does feel like, yes, okay, maybe her looking miserable in every picture is part of an aesthetic that she's agreed with Ye for modeling hit the stuff that he wants her to wear.
Also, the photo that he posted, like the first picture of Bianca that Kanye dropped prior to her birthday, was in those tiny, tiny little pants. And there were pictures of Kim wearing those tiny little pants as well. And I don't know, it feels like a very odd, almost deliberate comparison.
Yes, agreed. I mean, all the comments are like, why are you just trying to get Bianca to like your ex-wife?
Blink for help.
I mean, what is so funny, I mean, this just shows where the internet has just become some crazy place, is that the drama of System of a Down is like hectoring Kanye on his most recent post, being like, this is not how you treat women. And then everyone's commenting like, why the fuck is the drama of System of a Down like giving Kanye like lessons in morality in 2024? Yeah. It's just gone weird. The whole world has gone very odd.
The absolute audacity as well that he kicked off when Kim Kardashian posted nude pictures when they were together.
Yes.
He said it was like too sexy and inappropriate. Oh, okay, so it's inappropriate for Kim to do it, but you can post pictures of like your wife's pretty much naked boobs with the exception of a slither of black fabric across the nips. That's fine, but it wasn't for Kim.
Yeah, that is so double standards. I mean, I just really worry about her because if, yeah, she's, her friends have all said that she's radically changed. She, her Instagram's gone. She's dyed her hair a different color. She's cut it all off. She's dressing in a completely radically different way to how she used to be. She's not speaking, it seems, in public.
It's very, very odd. Should we do a quick background on her?
Yes.
For those that don't know.
Good idea.
So guys, as we just said, Bianca has just turned 29. She's Australian. She grew up in Melbourne. Reports say that she grew up in the Melbourne suburb of Ivanhoe, which is described as an affluent area.
Mm-hmm. So apparently, according to the Daily Beast, she comes from a mob family. Apparently, she is the daughter of an infamous Melbourne mob boss by the name of Elia Leo Sensori.
It's fascinating.
I know. He had done time in the 80s and was sentenced to 5 years in prison for heroin possession charges, and her uncle, Eris Sensori, is known for being a violent gangster currently serving life in prison for murder.
Gosh.
And before going behind bars, he also earned the name Melbourne's Al Capone.
Wow.
For being so brutal.
It's a very, very intriguing backstory, isn't it?
Yeah.
An old friend of hers spoke on a Nova FM radio show. Her name was Kate. So for those that don't know, by the way, Bianca was head of architecture at Yeezy. This friend Kate explained that this job came about because Ye apparently slid into her DMs while she was studying at the University of Melbourne. So just FYI, she did a BA and an MA in architecture. The friend alleges that she's not even sure if Bianca actually properly graduated because she may well have left to go and work for Yeezy. It's interesting because I feel like given how publicly available everyone's information is in this day and age with the internet, there's a lot of mystique still around her, isn't there?
Yes, she has a LinkedIn profile and it does say she completed her BA and MA. And I mean, of course, you'd have to complete your BA to do the MA. Maybe she didn't quite finish the MA.
Maybe she didn't finish the MA. Maybe yeah, that was it. Also, one of the things that I thought was a bit questionable that this so-called former friend said, quote was, "I knew her pretty well. She was definitely in the popular group and she was known for her big boobs. That was kind of her thing." Questionable.
So rude.
Really inappropriate thing to say.
As someone who has big boobs, it's not a thing.
Are you offended? It's literally not a thing. It's just how you look.
Yeah.
It's not a fucking fashion trend. It's your body.
My USP is my boobs. I think that's very disrespectful. However, and I've said this before, I have become incredibly wary of these alleged sources. I genuinely think it's journalists pretending
making
it up, and you just say, oh, a source
said X. I mean, exactly. I suppose also being like known for her big boobs, well, you could like look at a photograph and make that up. It's not like a private piece of information that no one would ever know unless they did literally go to school with her.
Exactly. And these are sources that don't need to be corroborated because you don't have a name or anything, so you could just,
this friend though did go on a radio show.
Oh, she went on a radio show.
So very brazen.
But then also, like, was she even a friend or is she just some rando cashing in? Also, Cathers, what does it mean to be head of architecture at Yeezy?
God knows. Because I know they had lots of highfalutin' plans at one point before Ye's kind of fall from grace, I suppose. I remember a GQ, American GQ interview with him where they went to his big Wyoming ranch and he had these crazy plans to like build like cities and stuff. There was serious architectural plans.
Interesting. So she was. So it wasn't even like architecture in terms of clothing. I mean, whatever that could
mean. Yeah, I think he had grand plans for like cityscapes, literally.
I see. Okay. Very confusing. I really just hope she's okay.
I hope she's okay as well. I do have a quite sort of pessimistic feeling that 5 years' time she'll come out with a similar-ish narrative to Julia Fox, as you've mentioned.
I agree. I also wonder if them getting married so quickly was maybe, again, a part of coercive control on his part, because once you lock someone into marriage, it's quite difficult for them to leave.
And there was quite a lot of debate about whether they were officially married. So publications would refer to her as Ye's wife in like quotation marks, but their wedding certificate proving that the marriage is official was actually reported in October 2023. So they are definitely married.
Interesting. Whenever I've seen it, well, I saw a video of, I think it was one of his album launches, and he's like doing a speech while slinging an arm over her shoulder. And again, it's that really weird thing where he's got so many clothes on. Every part of his body is covered up, but she's got almost nothing on. And the way his arm is on her whilst he's speaking is so unnecessary and so possessive.
So possessive. That's exactly the right word.
You just do not need to be giving a speech about your new album with your arm slung over Bianca.
As if she's like a cool new handbag. That's like slung over your shoulder. Also very questionable to kind of promote that type of treatment of women in front of his daughter. I hate that kind of argument of think of your daughters and your sisters and whatever, like you should just treat women well, regardless of your female relatives.
Absolutely.
But Chicago West and Northwest, his two daughters, are often photographed with them, with Bianca in various states of undress. And I think that that is like not an appropriate model.
Mm, agreed.
In front of your children. Like that's the treat that, okay, so you're showing your daughter that that's how you treat women.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Also, I've seen pictures where she is out and about without Kanye. I think particularly in November, she like apparently fled back to Australia. Her friends did an intervention. They went on a break. And there, it's so notable how different she is when she's not with him. She's like laughing, covered up, wearing, you know, lots of normal clothes. Let's keep tabs on this because I think it's there will be a development. I agree. So also, Katha, speaking of viral fame, on Friday night, I watched the film Sick of Myself.
Go on.
So it's a Norwegian black comedy. The director, Christopher Borgli, called it a very unromantic comedy. It came out earlier this year and got a bit of hype. But then I saw it last week on the Guardian's Best Films of 2023 that you may not have seen. And since it's all about personal branding and viral fame, I rented it on Amazon Prime for £3.49. And I thought it was really good. But, and I'll get into it later, the critics are very polarized. Some people think it's like disgustingly crude, immoral.
Wow.
And then others like me who think it's quite funny.
Els, I have some very exciting news that is definitely going to make our January that little bit brighter.
Oh, thank God, babes. Tell me right now.
So, Yonder have actually added most delicious drinking and dining partners to its January experiences, and I'm dying to tell you about them just so we can pick one and go together and have a much-deserved New Year's treat.
Yes, Cathers, go on.
So, we can choose between Hoppers and King's Cross, one of my faves, Frenchie in Covent Garden, Italian Spot Artusi in Peckham, Gastropub the Bull and Last in Highgate, Seafood Restaurant, Orisea in Notting Hill, Carrochios for Mexican in Stoke Newington, Thai Place Plaza in Tottenham Court Road, Arcade Food Hall also in Tottenham Court Road, and deep breath, Calais, a Thai restaurant in London Bridge from the founders of Somsa, and our fave cocktail bar Swift in Soho.
I am salivating. Get me to all of them right now. So Plaza I've actually been to, proper authentic no frills Thai food, highly recommend. Yum. Swift is one of my favorite cocktail bars, best Irish coffee in London. Yeah. You heard it here. And Frenchie has been on my special occasion list for years.
It looks so bougie, we have to go. Also, yes, babe, you can get a lot of the build paid for with your points. So guys, if you don't already know, Yonder is a lifestyle credit card that allows you to collect points for every pound you spend, and these points are then redeemable at Yonder's monthly changing selection of partners across food, drink, fitness and wellness in London, as well as travel across the UK and even online shopping.
Right, I've got about 100 quid's worth of points right now, so I can probably get a meal for two for free on Yonder.
Unreal. Thank you so much to our amazing partner Yonder. Get your first month free and 10,000 points when you join, then £15 a month thereafter. Please make sure you borrow responsibly. T's and C's apply. Rep 66.7% APR variable. Right, okay, so give me the download.
So basically, it's set in an arty district of Oslo in the present day among a 20-something group of arty thieves who essentially fund their bohemian lifestyle by stealing things like furniture and wine, which, fun fact, is directly inspired by the director's friends who used to do that and then all got busted. And one of these artists, Thomas, is becoming famous and increasingly self-obsessed. And his girlfriend, Signe, who works in a cafe, hasn't really got much going on, becomes increasingly jealous and bitter of the attention he's getting. And this friction becomes more and more dangerous because actually what's clear is that Signe is a pathological narcissist, pathological liar, fantasist. She's so obsessed with attention that she lies and exaggerates wildly to get it. And it starts off with things like she thinks she should have her own podcast. She just wants to be the center of attention. But then as her jealousy with Thomas, her boyfriend, gets bigger, she resorts to more disturbing ways to get attention, which is prompted by one day at the cafe helping a woman who gets bitten in the neck by a dog. And she is the first person to help the woman and therefore gets blood all over her white cafe shirt and her hair and her face. And she looks like she's been in a serious accident herself because she's covered in blood. This isn't a spoiler, by the way. This is all in like the blurbs in the trailer. So lo and behold, she's covered in blood and she suddenly gets all this attention. People on the street are filming her with their phones. All the paramedics are like, are you okay? Her boyfriend's really worried about her. Everyone's asking her if she's okay. And there's a really funny scene where when her and her boyfriend later have sex, she's like, ask me if I'm okay. And he's like, are you okay? I'm really worried about you. And like, she gets off on being asked if she's okay, which I just think is quite a funny, like, black critique on a lot of the behavior that we see in the modern world at the moment.
Yeah. What do you think it is trying to say?
So I think it is a dark but funny critique of main character syndrome.
Yeah.
Of the grotesque lengths people will go to get viral fame and to find a personal brand, and the skewering of performative victimhood that we sometimes see online. Because what then happens after she gets this taste of like fame through just having helped a woman with a
dog bite.
She, and again, this is not a spoiler, it's in all the blurbs and the trailer, she gets hold of this dodgy Russian medication called Lixdol on the black market that is in the news because it gives people these awful facial deformities.
Oh.
And, I mean, bear in mind, this film is not meant to be like psychorealism. Like it is.
That's a fake medication.
It's all apparent. It's all very dark. But yeah, she gets hold of this medication on purpose to get some of these facial deformities that will get her the same kind of concern from her social circle that she got when she was covered in blood. So
Gosh. She's
in a hospital, then her sort of deformities get worse. Like she signs with a modeling agency that like advocates non-conformist beauty. People are interviewing her. She's like the face of like being beautiful, but it's a very funny look at how victimhood, I guess, in this very like online way. There's always going to be someone that's going to have a worse time than you, and you're always going to be out-victimed. So there's this really funny scene where after she does her interview with a journalist about, you know, her hardship with her face, there's then like she gets bumped down the homepage by an active shooter story, and she's so outraged, she rings up the journalist, is like, I'm sorry, but like, can you get it back to where it was? And they're like, well, there is an active shooter in Oslo. And she can't even understand why that would be more important.
So is she the main character more than the partner who actually gets famous?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's just, is watching all these deranged lengths that she goes to keep being the main character, even when obviously she's genuinely mutilating herself. And there's all these little twists and turns. There are these really funny scenes where, for instance, she's at a dinner party and everyone's ignoring her. And she's, you know, I actually empathize with this, but you know, when you say something and everyone ignores you and it's so awkward in a social situation and you're like, do I say it again? Or like, why
did
is no one
hear
listening?
Me? Yeah. Am I going to repeat myself?
Yeah. Which I've had, particularly if you're nervous and you probably said it quite quietly and like unassumingly. So yeah, she says this thing, everyone ignores her, then her boyfriend Thomas is like having all the attention about his art again, so then she just pretends that she has a nut allergy to be difficult with the chef, so then everyone turns to her and it's like, wow, how serious is your nut allergy? And she goes on about how it's like actually like near fatal and blah blah blah. And once she becomes like this person of interest with this nut allergy, she re-says the thing that was first ignored, and suddenly everyone's like, fascinating, and she's like the center of attention. So it's using that little nugget and then like exploding it to grotesque proportions later on in the film. But critics have said, so Peter Bradshaw, who I usually love and agree with everything he says, hated it. He said it was too obvious satire and very clumsy, and that there were bits that were not okay, like when they satire the non-conformist modelling agency that she's part of. He's like, well, obviously a non-conformist modelling agency is a good thing.
There's actually a massive positive to why would you piss out of it.
Yeah, and I do agree with that, actually. I think maybe they get a bit confused with the satire there. But then I think what they were trying to say is the brands that then work with that agency, are they doing it with good intentions? Mm. Like, why?
It's like tokenism more than it is actual...
Exactly.
...a celebration of diverse beauty.
And then the FT... gave it 4 stars and said, some may consider Sick of Myself objectionably flippant or callous about such real world malaises as Munchausen syndrome or histrionic personality disorder. But that's the point, the director suggesting that in the age of 24-hour online persona, Western society in general has assumed the characteristics of what were once marginal pathological states.
Oh,
which I think is accurate. But then The Times was just like, it's disgusting body horror. The Spectator said it was so tastelessly disturbing.
It's a horror.
It's not. I mean, it's a bit squeamish, but that's it.
Would I like it? Be honest.
I think it is funny. I think it's quite clever in lots of ways, and I was really like chuckling most of the way through.
And that humour still very much translates, even though you're reading it via the subtitles.
Yes.
Good.
And I think, I mean, it's silly, like. So some of the critiques were like, oh, it's just not psychorealistic.
It's not meant to be taken seriously.
Well, it's obviously, because I mean, who would really do that? But then sometimes I see stuff on Instagram where I'm like...
People do some weird shit, man.
Yeah, the stuff that people, that, like the women that go online to talk about their like how, I don't know, their nights with a rapper or something.
It's quite
like,
Munchausen-y.
Oh, it's like you come off so badly in this that you're embarrassing yourself. Like some of the stories people go out with are so embarrassing. I'm like, I can't believe you're sharing this, but like the clout outweighs the shame.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
And I can imagine someone not obviously mutilating themselves for attention, but
people
fucking up their lives.
Shit for attention, let's face it. And I think social media has made that 10 times worse.
And the main character energy is something we've talked about a lot on this podcast.
Yeah.
Is like seeing, I think that maybe is the thing in the film, is that she kind of detaches from her own reality and sees her like body as like this little avatar that she can direct around. And God. Then it all catches up with her that like she has actually just ruined her face for life. But
God, it sounds a little bit depressing, actually, rather than a
I think because it's
fun romp.
No, well, I think because it's so silly, like it's so absurd. Like even the facial deformity is like, it gets more and more ludicrous.
But these topics that I guess it's prompting you to think about are actually quite serious.
Yes.
So have you actually had quite a lot of reflection since watching it?
I feel like, yeah, so the director said it was about like the hell of personal branding. And I do think people making their personal brands actually quite, the things that are quite awful that have happened to them.
Yeah, I've always found that quite problematic. And I think we've touched on that even in terms of personal journalism.
Yeah. Yes. It's like, I mean, even to some extent, and I definitely don't want to put words in her mouth because she probably doesn't feel like this at all. But sometimes when I see the constant sponsored post for Elizabeth Day's My Fertility Sadness, and I'm like, gosh, the fact that you're...
What, is she working with like a fertility brand?
No, it's just, I think the Times is constantly promoting...
Oh, sorry, the Times pushed that story of her.
I see it all the time. And it's just like, Elizabeth Day, My Fertility Sadness. I'm like, at what point does that actually become deeply depressing that that is your personal brand?
And actually, the Sunday Times style piece by Camille Charary that I mentioned last week about fertility, I noticed in her comments on Instagram that there was a couple of people who were really disappointed that that article had a brand credit for Stripe and Stare, the underwear brand that she'd been working with. And someone had commented on Instagram, like, this was a really sensitive piece and I was really thrilled to read it until at the end I saw that you literally have a brand peg there. Like, what the hell? This is about infertility. And she's commented back saying, oh, it's because it's a female-founded brand and I refer to them in the piece. When I felt so uncomfortable in my body during the IVF process. So she kind of explained it, but clearly people took real issue with a piece being about something as sensitive as infertility, having any brand connection at all.
Exactly. And also, even though it was such a silly film, I was thinking at the time, like, okay, say this really had happened to her and she did become, her whole life and her whole career became about like advocating for nonconformist beauty, which is a worthwhile cause, of course. But I can imagine it must get drained. Like, imagine being like, okay, that is my career. I've got to keep talking about how I look different for the next 40 years.
And I've always thought that with actors as well, like you must have to have such a thick skin if you have a very specific, non-conventionally attractive look and then you're constantly cast in those roles.
Yes.
That really must knock your self-confidence, your ego in some way. Like, oh, here's a role for extremely ugly woman. Like, that's the perfect one for you.
I mean, I didn't even know this, but one of my colleagues told me the other day that there is a London casting agency called Ugly Models Agency.
Yes, I've heard of this.
Yes. I mean, obviously, should caveat that there is no such thing as ugly. Beauty is all in the eye of the beholder and, you know, there is no ugly and beautiful. But I guess they're making a point of that with the name.
Exactly.
So yes, all in all, I do recommend watching it, simply if it's, you know, you might hate it, you might think it's very funny. It's good to have the conversation.
Well, I will be going away and watching that. As much as you know, I hate subtitles.
Yes.
I've actually become slightly less of an ignorant Luddite on that topic in the last few years.
Well, Norway's having a moment. Did you hear the hype about Norway's worst person in the world? Do you remember when that came out?
Yes.
Really good rom-com. Anyway, babe, so I do recommend you go and watch that film. Just want to hear your thoughts. Now, on to your recommendation.
Yes, I am so excited to talk about Fool Me Once because I think it's safe to say it is the biggest series of 2024 so far.
My whole girl group is watching it. So
I'm so surprised you haven't watched it.
Well, I was waiting for you to tell me all about it.
Kind. So it's based on a novel of the same name by Harlan Coben, who is a crime writer who has a deal with Netflix. So he's got lots of shows on there, including The Stranger. There's one, I think, called The Innocent. Hold Tight. Yeah. But Fool Me Once, oh my God, it's so good. I think everyone is in complete agreement. It's a fast-moving, like, psychological thriller. 8 episodes. It stars Michelle Keegan as Maya Stern, Richard Armitage as her husband Joe, Adil Akhtar as D.I. Sammy Kearse. And I have to say, I love Adil Akhtar. So he is in Four Lions, one of the best films ever.
Yes, I watched that recently. Riz Ahmed.
Really, that's random.
I know. It's because, I don't know why, it was free on Amazon or something.
He's in Sweet Tooth, which I love. Another, like, the Netflix dystopia. And he's also in Utopia. Do you remember that show?
You know, I've never seen that.
Have you not? He was excellent in that. He's such a good actor. Anyway, Fool Me Once centers on Michelle Keegan's Maya Stern, who is a military pilot who's suffering from PTSD, and her wealthy husband is murdered. Suddenly, nothing is as it seems.
Oh.
Apparently, Cobben actually based Michelle Keegan's character on a combat helicopter pilot who he'd met who'd served in the Gulf War. And he was interested in the question of what happens when that person is trying to come back into the real world. And then the show asks, what happens if said person, say, sees her murdered husband laughing on the nanny cam? So that's where the mystery unfolds.
So he's not dead?
Well, we don't know. I don't want to do any spoilers because honestly, it's like, you know where each episode has a cliffhanger?
Right, right. Okay.
It's very much a pacey thriller. So if I say too much, I'm going to kind of ruin it. So I want to tread very carefully here.
Very good idea. So am I right in thinking that because they're a wealthy couple, we get lots of fun property porn?
Yes. It's actually giving Saltburn a bit in the sense that a beautiful, grand country home is kind of the epicenter of the drama. And even like the credits focusing on that. It's kind of this idea of a very upper class family. Joanna Lumley plays the mother of the murdered husband. So
love
her
it.
Mother-in-law, Michelle Keegan's, she's excellent.
Is she really funny in it or is she serious?
She is funny, but in that kind of biting, satirical way.
I see.
It's not AdFab laugh out loud jokes at all.
Michelle Keegan, I love her in Uniform. She was very good in Our Girl.
She's so good. And she often plays these military roles, yes, which is quite interesting. I read a fascinating interview with her, with Eva Wiseman in The Guardian as well, that touches on lots of very us topics.
Oh, yeah. Hit me.
Of course, she was a long time character on Coronation Street. And her, I guess, trajectory on swapping soaps, which are traditionally derided for hard hitting dramas, has been like a really difficult transition for her. She was on Corrie for 6 years. And I think her trajectory is quite fascinating when it comes to the complicated world of class, accent, beauty, tabloid celebrity. And now she's actually taking on this like really gritty role where she's brilliant. And so it's a kind of real moment for her, I think.
Yes. I think Michelle Keegan is someone that is often sidelined as just like one of those, soap actresses who does like BBC, the odd good BBC drama. She hasn't taken that seriously, is she?
Not really. And actually, she left Corrie in 2015. Like, it's been a while.
She's really good.
Yeah, she's really good. And she makes a very interesting point in this interview with Eva Wiseman that there's a lot of snobbery surrounding soaps. Mm. So she says because soaps are seen as working class, that's why people look down on them.
Right, yeah.
And actually, one of the things that she talks about that I thought was fascinating is how difficult it was for her, I guess some might assume ironically, to be labelled the world's sexiest woman or winning sexiest female at like the Soap Awards.
I just can't believe that's still a thing.
Times. She won sexiest female 12 times. Yes, okay, great to be noticed. But actually, she'd been doing storylines on abortion, murder, surrogacy, perjury, and never got Best Actress once. And pretty damn pissed off about it, quite frankly.
So it's an award show where other people were winning
just at various
soap
awards. Yeah, she's always won best sexiest female and nothing else.
And there were other people getting proper like
well,
awards
obviously
for
there's
their
best,
work.
Yeah, there's best actress awards.
Oh,
all of these.
I see.
So like various soap awards obviously have all different categories. Yeah. She's never won in any category at any soap awards other than sexiest female.
That's ridiculous. Also, aren't there more sexy people in soaps? Like, surely there are other sexy people that could
win. Well, apparently not. People are literally obsessed with her and the way she looks. It is quite interesting. She was also crowned FHM's Sexiest Woman Alive in 2015. And I really like the way that she takes aim at that in this interview. Where she talks about how her career was reshaping itself, she talks about how sort of safe Corrie did feel as a family environment, but how intimidated she felt in the wider industry. And she recalls on one of her first magazine shoots, like literally putting her hand up to ask if she could go to the loo.
Oh, babes.
And her quote is, it was the norm back then to do sexy spreads in men's magazines and go to the award ceremonies where they'd have sexiest female. I was never comfortable with it. Eva asks, was there pressure to do it? And Michelle says, yes, I felt pressure and I'm a bit of a people pleaser. I tried to go with the flow, but there was something in me that was like, I really don't want this. I don't want to be on the front cover in my underwear. So eventually I gathered the courage, Eva says, to say no. No, to ask for a cardigan, she chuckles. Once I was like, no, I don't like it. So to fix it, they put a bobble hat on my head. And the sexiest female awards, Eva asks. It was embarrassing because I was in a lot of heavy storylines. There was one where I felt like I was crying every day for months and months. And then at the end of it, when the accolade was sexiest female, it was so frustrating. She gives a resigned sigh. And the funny thing is, I'm not even sexy. I've never been sexy. My friends have always laughed about it. Even when I say the word, it makes me cringe. Okay, no hate, Michelle. She's amazing. But I'm like, I'm sorry, you are objectively sexy.
Yes.
As much as beauty is in the eye of the beholder, as we just said, Michelle Keegan is genetically blessed.
She is incredibly genetically blessed. I mean, yeah, I think it's probably, considering how good I thought she was on Our Girl and other things, I refuse to believe that there are that she isn't one of the best actors in soaps. But
she's a brilliant actor. There's absolutely no doubt about that. I think she's super compelling and believable.
But, you know, okay, yeah, she hasn't been in a Hollywood film. I think there is a snobbery as well for people who haven't ever made it outside of TV.
Yes, although her trajectory, I think, is going to hopefully follow the kind of Saran Jones trajectory. Saran Jones was obviously a Corrie star, and now she's done loads of hard-hitting BBC dramas and things like that. Well, she's not a Hollywood actor, but she's still incredibly well-respected in Britain.
Yeah, but then I guess Michelle Keegan has done hard-hitting things. So why is there still a difference?
Also, Michelle says that, I think in the same interview, she went over to LA when her husband, Mark Wright, former Anyways Essex star, was working out there, and she says she doesn't like it.
Yeah.
She was like, I'm not into Hollywood. I would do it if like the work came up, but didn't like LA.
I think you're right. I think there's definite classism there. And the fact that she's married to Mark Wright.
Yeah, when they got married in 2015, their wedding was on the cover of Hello, which made them completely irresistible to all the tabloids.
Right, yeah.
Which may or may not have worked in her favour, as you say.
Whereas Saran Jones is someone like, she just rarely goes out. She's said before she like doesn't like going out. She doesn't like going to parties. She doesn't like drinking. She does. She's quite like austere in her private life.
Definitely.
I mean, Keely Hawes is another one, isn't she? A bit like Saran, who's like been very well respected, is just like constant jobbing, like primetime drama actress, has never really made it into Hollywood, but is still treated quite seriously.
Yeah, on that, Michelle has actually said that she's made an active choice to pull back from the tabloids. She talks about it in the piece. So she says the amount of attention that she and Mark Wright got when they got together made her very uncomfortable. She says, people spoke openly about our relationship. As time progressed, quite negative stories came out. There was lots of damaging pieces saying, oh, they split up, they've done this. She said, so we came to the conclusion that we should keep our relationship private just for us. She stopped going to parties, stopped being photographed on red carpets. And she said, it's worked out much better. As we've got older, it's become more natural for us. She said she also noticed a tonal change in how the media treat her. She said, it used to be circles on your cellulite, or saying you lost too much weight, or speculating whether someone's pregnant. You don't see that in the press so much anymore, but the judgment's still there. People are now judging you online, and the media are then allowed to pick up on it by reporting on what you said, which I think is a very astute point, because we've said this before. Now, the way the media get around being vitriolic to famous people is quoting what other people have said on Twitter.
Yes. Hiding behind other people's words. Yeah, and I also noticed that, okay, yes, the Daily Mail don't necessarily do circles of shame anymore, but they do these quite weird, taunting headlines where they'll have someone in a bikini and be like, flaunts her, like, ample bosom, but it will still be a shit picture.
Oh, totally. They'll be like, so-and-so looks fabulous in a bikini, when it's like clearly a shit picture of them, like, lent over with like loads of rolls.
Exactly.
Or, you know, they pretend that it's a positive when it's actually clearly a negative, like clickbaity hater piece.
And the blogs will do that all the time. Like they're trolling the celebrity with their fake headline.
Literally. Like, so proud of so-and-so. Yeah. Or something will be the caption.
And then everyone's commenting like, Shea Burrow, we know what you're doing here.
Yeah.
Oh, it's difficult. Cathers, we have many pet peeves that unite us, but I must say one of the most notable has got to be our misophonia, which, as we've recently discovered, is the term used to describe a negative emotional reaction to common sounds.
Oh my God, babe, nothing enrages us quite like the sound of someone frothing at their desk or tapping away violently on their keyboard. For me, as someone that struggles with ADHD, distracting sounds are honestly such an issue when I'm trying to work. I actually can't cope.
Of course, which is why we're such big fans of the tiny, comfy and super unobtrusive Karma earbuds from our brilliant podcast sponsor, Flare Audio. Cathers, how do they work? Take it away.
Well, huns, our ears are shaped like shells, so the sound we receive is always distorted at about 20%. Most people's brains filter that out, but if, like me and Elle's, yours needs a little bit of a helping hand, then the Karma earbuds are just perfect.
Such an upgrade, I have to say, from my noise-cancelling headphones, which are very antisocial when you're in the office and a colleague's trying to talk to you and block you off from sounds you actually really need to hear. Don't just take our word for it either, guys. They've sold 2 million pairs since the launch of lockdown, and they even do mini versions for kids and a new version called Karma Soft, which is an extra soft option for those with more sensitive ears.
So go to flareaudio.com to snap up your Karma earbuds.
Thank you so much to Flare. To be honest, I actually have never watched an interview with Michelle Keegan. I wonder.
I do think she is quite private. This did ring true to me because while she's a tabloid favourite, you rarely see much about her. I think what's also really interesting, she's 36.
Yes.
And one of the main realisations he had is this saying no to things you don't feel comfortable with, whether that's lingerie shoots or parties or questions about marriage or questions about babies. She did an interview with The Mirror the other day and I was like, ratings to you, Michelle, because she outed those questions around pregnancy and when they're having kids as totally sexist. So as I said, her and Mark Wright got married in 2015. They've been married 8 years and they are pummeled with questions about when they're going to start a family. I noticed even in comments on Instagram, just fans will message saying, when are you having kids? The only thing that's missing is a baby. People are very vocal about the fact that they feel that they should be having children. She said to The Mirror, it's horrible. People don't know if we're trying. They don't know the background of what's happening. In this day and age, you shouldn't be asking questions like that. I'm asked purely because I'm a woman, but I'm immune to it now. It's like a reaction. And as soon as I hear it, I brush it off because it's no one else's business. I'm just like, thank you, Michelle.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not a celebrity, preach, but when people ask me, I get really annoyed.
Which is quite funny, though, in terms of what we've just been saying about the papers or tabloids trying to have like what they think is a sly angle. So said piece with The Mirror, where I saw these quotes, they then at the bottom have like unearthed every other quote that she's ever said about having children. So they're like, in 2018, Michelle Keegan did say that she was broody and would like to have four of them.
Oh, my God.
So they've made it a piece about not being asked about having kids with every quote that she or Mark have ever said about having kids.
Oh, I mean, I actually have, I'm sure I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I had a kind of problem with one celebrity who was in Normal People, Sarah Green. I interviewed her. We got on really well. She was very preoccupied at the time.
Connell's mother.
Yes, Connell's mother. She was very preoccupied at the time of the pressure on women to have work done.
Yes.
Which was about 2 years ago. It was a massive talking point and it was really upsetting her. It was literally like making her think that maybe she wasn't cut out for Hollywood. Didn't want to see herself on screen. So we had a big old discussion about that. And then I wrote it up and that was the focus of the interview. So I made it the focus of the piece. And I thought it was a feminist angle for me because I was like, yeah, we need to have more conversations about the pressures on women.
And aging.
And aging. And then the next, when it was published a week later or whatever, the publicist rang up my boss and was like, Sarah is so upset. She really loved the interview, but then felt that Eleanor took a deeply unfeminist angle of making it all about what, you know, the work that women might have done and the aesthetics of Hollywood.
That's so unfortunate, isn't it, that what you thought was a feminist take actually then was rendered as anti-women.
I know,
by the subject.
But also it's like,
Christ.
Well, if you talk about something at great length, then you know
that... Did she just not even want to have her name associated talking about women having work done?
Yeah, I think maybe she was embarrassed. I think actually is what happened. I think also she wasn't that famous then. It was like her first big role. And then she's saying that she's worried that people aren't going to cast her in Hollywood because she is too old. Like, I think she was quite offended actually that she was cast as Connell's mother.
Oh, how old is she?
I think she was only like 36 or something. And obviously Connell's like...
Well, he's only meant to be about 16, isn't he? And in fairness to the book, she's meant to be a very young mother.
So she's 39. When I interviewed her, I think she was probably 37. I think, but she was, I remember her saying she was a bit offended that she's constantly getting cast in like mother roles.
I mean, that's super annoying, isn't it? And this is a major issue for women. You're either essentially the teenage daughter, the early 20s hot love interest, or you're the motherly shrew.
Yes.
And there's nothing in between.
Exactly.
We touched on that last week, didn't we?
We did.
But as a general societal issue as well. You're either too young or too old.
I know that age gaps, we seem to keep talking about it, but now every time I see, you know, ex male celebrity is now dating someone, they're always 20 years younger. You know, Bradley Cooper and Gigi Hadid.
Yes. But he likes the younger women. Case in point, when he was with Suki Waterhouse.
Oh, you're right. What about Irina Shayk?
Oh yeah, she was closer to his age. But even now, as we just touched upon, Bianca and Kanye, she's 29 and he's in his 40s.
He's 46 or something, isn't he?
Goodness me.
But, bit of good news, I do keep seeing in the Times and stuff, women writing either anonymous pieces or being interviewed saying that they have never had so much attention from young men as they are now in their 40s
and
50s. Yeah,
it's like an era of the cougar, isn't it?
It's a cougar era, it's my era, as we know.
Do you know what I was actually flicking through literally this morning as well? Aaron Taylor Johnson's holiday pictures from he and Sam's New Year's trip in Jamaica.
Yes.
They look very happy.
And Madonna's got a little toy boy, doesn't she?
She does. Love it.
Love it.
I'm here for it.
I love hearing about women's sexual liberation in their 40s and 50s. I mean, that's still young, by the way. Long may it continue well into their 90s.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So back to Michelle Keegan.
Back to Michelle Keegan.
After that little tangent, I have to say she is brilliant in Fool Me Once. She has absolutely proven any remaining soap-hating doubters wrong. Interestingly, though, she does say in the Guardian piece that she has real imposter syndrome. I mean, I know everyone always says that, but with her, I'm like, I actually do get it. And I thought what was quite telling is she does root that specifically to class. So she says, I've always thought I had to act and speak a particular way. I didn't want people to look down on me, but there are so many great actors now who come from working class backgrounds who represent people like me, like Jodie Comer and Stephen Graham. They're so comfortable and so proud of who they are. They've helped me realize that I don't have to change my accent when I go into these rooms.
Great.
Really great. And you so, love Stephen Graham.
I am obsessed.
I need to watch Boiling Point the series. I still haven't.
Cathers, you're going to love it.
Okay.
You're going to absolutely love it.
Oh my God, I'm excited.
Particularly because we watched Boiling Point
together the film, on the plane.
On the plane. Well, that's fascinating. Okay, I'm going to go and watch it then. Am I going to like it? So my friends said it was mental. They were like, I can't believe how mad it is.
It is quite wild and it touches on very relevant topics. Okay. And I won't say too much, but from technology to the military and the fallout of recent wars that Britain's been involved in. Mm-hmm. It covers a lot.
On the topic of military and technology, I think you would love The Capture. Have you seen it yet?
I don't know if I have.
It's a BBC show starring Papa Esiju, who I always think is amazing.
No, I have seen this.
A company that is able to digitally, like, edit live footage.
Wow. And like, oh my God, kind of thing.
And deep fake, like perfects deep fake technology to the point where they're using people's likenesses like to do interviews on the news, like hired by the government.
God, how have I not seen this?
I think you would love it so much.
This is the blurb on BBC. Can you really believe what you see? An ambitious young DCI enters the terrifying world of deepfake technology as the fabric of reality starts to fray.
Yeah.
It generates so many interesting
conversations. Yeah, because you're like, oh my God, we will get to a situation where we can't even trust a newsreader on BBC because they could be deepfaked.
But this is a real issue. Okay, love it. I am 100% going to watch that.
Everyone go and watch it and then report back here.
The final thing I will say on Michelle Keegan is do go and have a look at her home account, which she shares with Mark Wright, at Wrighty Home. I have to say, I didn't know they shared anything like that because I've always assumed she was someone that was protecting her privacy. But it in fact charts the build of their grand mansion, their £3.5 million grand mansion in Essex. It is just, it's quite epic. And you know, we like a bit of property porn.
We do like a bit of property porn. Unpopular, very toxic opinion, but isn't this the kind of thing that she shouldn't be having if she wants to be taken more seriously?
Oh, totally. I do agree with you. There was one picture I clicked on and the house looks slightly absurd. Like it's this huge, huge mansion. I'll just show you this.
Oh, wow.
So she's posted this photo, guys, of like one of her dogs having a morning walk, but the house looms very large in the background. It looks like a huge country hotel. And literally the top comment is, why do you feel the need to show off to the world? Just keep your good fortune to yourself. No thought to those that are struggling in the world. People can't afford to pay their bills and can't afford food through no fault of their own. How do you think this makes them feel? I'm like, oh, that is...
Yeah, but then also it's like the people who are so poor that they can't afford like running water are not on Instagram checking Michelle Keegan's like house building anyway. Like, and it's kind of what we were saying about the sick of myself. It's like I hate this word because it sounds like oppression isn't a real thing when obviously it is, but the oppression Olympics online, performative oppression. And I mean, everything is so relative to the point where like you could be like, I'm dying of cancer, but I still have my home and I haven't been, you know... I haven't lost my entire family.
Yeah.
You can keep going and
it's a sliding scale.
I
mean, she's definitely ignoring all the comments clearly and has continued to sort of shamelessly post mansion renovation updates. So clearly isn't worrying her too much.
I mean, I just don't, the journalist in me is thinking why. So it's called Mark and Michelle, follow us while we create our dream home. And they've got 606,000 followers. Are they doing it for like spawn stuff? Are they getting free furniture?
I don't know. Cause I did have a little look through. What's in it for them?
I can see an ad. Ooh. Mark Wright, # ad Vuba.
Oh, there we go.
So Vuba resin products work. Yeah. Resin for our rear driveway. So they're using it to get free shit.
It does also spurn a lot of tabloid stories. So updates about the house have featured in The Sun, in the Daily Mail. There'll be stories about their Christmas decorations, their trouble choosing the right shade of white. And it's like, well, she's obviously not that uncomfortable with the attention.
Right, then. So has she literally got, after all that she said, she's literally using her home decor page to actually get more headlines in the tabloids.
But then there's this very strange bit in the piece that I think really speaks to this whole thing. I'm going to quote it directly. Talking about the house, Keegan suddenly starts to cry. Mid-build. I was filming in Australia, she said, the BBC historical drama, £10 Poms, and I hadn't seen the house for months. And when I walked in, Mark had lit all the candles and I couldn't speak for 5 minutes. He was like, what do you think? Worried, anxious, this was a project he'd been working on since 2020. I just couldn't find the words to say how I felt because I was so overwhelmed. I just burst out crying. She apologises, pushing away the tears. It still gets me emotional because we've worked really hard for it. We've had to make a lot of sacrifices. I've missed lots of milestones in my life due to work. Mark went to LA and we spent months apart, which was hard, but it's worth it. She takes a breath and sips her coffee. And the house, it's also about security because you never know when this is all going to end. So that says to me that the house is kind of symbolic or emblematic of her entire success and status.
Yes.
They're like incredibly proud of it, and I get that.
Of course. However,
a bit tone deaf still though.
A bit tone deaf, a bit annoying. And also every single post I go on now is
an ad.
Ooh, Granite Labs UK. How great. And it's like a slab of marble with Michelle Keegan. Like, we spent hours choosing our different piece of marble.
Okay,
thank you.
So
hashtag PR product.
It was literally a ploy just to get the house done up for free.
Can't really. You fucking pay for it? Like, surely they've got
the money to pay for it.
I think this is really actually deeply annoying.
That's a slightly different spin on much of those quotes that I've read out from the Guardian interview, doesn't it? Let's face it.
Literally every post is like hashtag PR product or
like
hashtag
every single possible post. Especially when you've got this narrative about stepping back from the tabloids and having real privacy around your relationship and your life. Is it that private? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you're literally showing us pictures of your toilet.
That's actually really funny.
However, I must say it does seem like it's maybe more Mark Wright's personal Instagram because it's lots of pictures of him.
Yes.
So maybe Michelle doesn't feel that comfortable.
On that.
They've definitely got a partnership with Granite Slab UK is all I'm telling you. Investigative journalism just took place live.
It did. Dear me. I do think it's quite interesting because she also does touch on happiness, and it really did remind me of an excellent Diary of a CEO, Stephen Bartlett, which I listened to recently.
Yes.
I dipped off a bit with those.
Yes, what are we thinking about him?
So I listened to the new one with Alain de Botton.
Yes.
Loved it. It's all about, you know, he's the kind of philosopher of love.
Yes.
He's like the ultimate modern day philosopher.
Yes.
And he talks a lot about happiness, and it's fascinating and
yes.
quite relevant to some of Michelle Keegan's quotes, because she says when asked how she feels about fame, I find it odd how people want it. Is it the recognition they want? Is it the adoration? Is it that they think fame equals money? I find that really interesting. Goes on to explain that she was chatting to two lads from Brassic, which is Sky's most successful comedy series in years, in which Michelle Keegan plays a single mum. And she says, chatting to these actors, they talked about, are we happier than our friends? One's an accountant, one's a banker, one's a teacher. I'm happy with my life, she says, but I'm definitely not happier. Which I thought was quite fascinating, because we do put famous people on a pedestal and we do have this weird idea that it makes you a more fulfilled, happy person. Actually, again, not rocket science, but it's, as you said, also a sliding scale.
It's a slight, exactly.
It's subjective.
So,
well, that's that on Fool Me Once, because otherwise I'm just getting into spoiler territory. Go and watch it. You're all going to love it. If you don't, then that in itself is an interesting point. So please let us know.
Please DM us. We've been having some great DMs recently.
Well, we have.
Really good ones on age gaps.
Yes.
Keep them coming, guys.
On the topic of age gaps,
oh, yeah.
Did you see that the guy whose story formed the biographical basis for May December, the film you talked about last week,
yes.
has commented.
Yes, I did. It was annoying because it came out just on the day the episode dropped.
I know. So I thought of you as soon as I saw know. It. And then I was like, I will not send it to her because she will have already seen it.
I saw it. So yes, he said he was offended because the production never got in touch with him. And he said it was particularly egregious, because literally they use like the front covers of the tabloid Scandal at the time, like the actual, they used like actual pictures of that.
Real life photographs of him are actually featured
on the newspapers, I guess.
I'm surprised they could do that.
And apparently they actually lift a bit of dialogue from an interview he and Marie-Kay Letourneur gave at the time as well. Because I do think there's a point of like, okay, look, if it's Lucy inspired, the production don't have to go and interview the real people that was very Lucy inspired by. But if you're lifting bits of dialogue from real interviews and using the actual tabloids from the time, then you should let him know at least.
All goes back to the thorny issue of crime reporting.
Yes.
And as we got so into last week.
And taking people's stories without their consent.
Yeah.
I can't wait for you to go and watch it and then let me know what you think.
I'm really excited. I'm going to watch it in the next few days and I will report back.
Okay, so finally, Cathers, we have been dying to debrief on Tomorrow, Tomorrow and Tomorrow.
The incredible book by Gabrielle Zevin. I think it was, in fact, the best-selling paperback of 2023.
Yes, it's had quite a...
paperback novel.
Sleeper. It's become a bit of a sleeper hit.
A sleeper hit.
Yeah.
Everyone's heard of it now, haven't they? It's one of those covers that people are like, oh, that book. Yeah, I've seen that. So Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, if you don't know, guys, is a kind of, it's also a kind of coming of age tale, isn't it? A friendship story. The novel follows the relationship between two friends who begin a successful video game company together. What's fascinating is that she's charting the history of video games through the narrative, isn't she?
Yes.
So it covers decades.
Yes. And Gabrielle Zevin is a keen gamer herself. And what's interesting is there aren't that many novels, I certainly haven't read any, that really pay tribute to the art and the beauty of video games, because they get so much bad press that this really takes them seriously as an art form.
Yeah, and I think that's why it was a sleeper hit, because everyone that reads this and recommends it has some kind of caveat, which is like, by the way, I'm not interested in video games, but I was interested in this. So it's very much a book that's for people that don't really know anything about video games. You don't have to be interested in it. And as you say, it really presents it as a very like... beautiful art form, an intellectual art form, one that's like really, really rooted in like philosophy and storytelling and quite complicated moral issues.
She actually says herself in an interview, video games are a form of literature in terms of it being a constructed and organized world that you can experience as a text.
We should say the reason that we're actually bringing this up today is because there's been a huge news story doing the rounds in the last week about a girl who was allegedly raped in the metaverse. So British police are investigating the case of a minor who was allegedly subjected to a virtual gang rape.
Really interesting. Yeah, because I think one of the big themes in Tomorrow, Tomorrow and Tomorrow is Sam, so one of the protagonists, desire to build a better alternate moral world.
Where, it's about virtual utopias.
Yes, exactly. And he said, he actually said, Gabrielle Zevin writes in the book, it is not an inevitability that we should be our worst selves behind the mask of an avatar. What I believe to my very core is that virtual worlds can be better than the actual world. They can be more moral, more just, more progressive, more empathetic, and more accommodating of difference. And if they can be, shouldn't they be?
So one of the games that Sam and Sadie create is called Pioneers. It's based on an old school game called the Oregon Trail, which apparently was very big in the 80s, kind of before our time. Gabrielle Zevin has said in an interview that those kids, the people that were born in the late 70s, early 80s, her generation are the Oregon Trail generation, and they were the first generation to grow up on video games. Mm. So she says what was interesting to her was how, if you've used video games as a narrative experience for your entire life, how does that change your expectation of life itself?
Very interesting.
And the name Tomorrow, Tomorrow and Tomorrow actually has kind of two meanings or two references. So it's a Macbeth quote, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. And it's about, so it's a Macbeth quote, but it's also a gaming reference to the fact that in games you never actually die.
Yes.
So it's this possibility of infinite rebirth, of infinite redemption, but also, and this is the Macbeth reference, the futility and relentlessness of life.
Yes. And I think Zevin says, you know, what, after all, is a video game subtextual preoccupation, if not the erasure of mortality?
Yeah. And actually what I meant to say before and then got completely off tangent was that one of the games they create is Pioneers, which is this kind of, it's like a farming game, like a simple build society games. And again, I'm not going to give too much away as to why they even designed that game in the first place, but Pioneers becomes this kind of virtual utopia where same-sex marriage has become a very dividing political issue at the time, and they allow for same-sex marriage within the game as a kind of antidote to the bigotry that's going on in the real world.
Yes.
However, that then has real-world implications for the people that design the game. So it's not without cost.
Yes, 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 exactly. Yeah. I think for me, what was really touching as I read the book was all the quotes about friendship and also forgiveness. So Sadie and Sam are these two childhood friends, and Sadie does something that Sam feels is kind of completely unforgivable. So they don't speak to each other for 6 years, but then they rekindle the friendship. And then there's this really moving bit where Sadie says, "Promise we won't ever do that again. Promise me you'll always forgive me, and I promise I'll always forgive you," which I found really moving. Because the idea of just like forgive, I mean, obviously.
And does Sadie stick to it?
Well,
what I would like to say is I found Sadie to be quite a dick.
I found them both quite insufferable in many ways.
But still compelling as characters, which I think speaks to the excellence of the writing, that you don't have to really like the protagonists.
Exactly.
You can still really enjoy the book and really admire them as like artistes. It's quite meta, isn't it, in terms of creating worlds?
It is. And also for anyone who's been in a fight with a friend, I found their bickering and their fight so realistic. The fact that they're completely misinterpreting each other's what the other thinks of them, which I think is that whenever you have a big fight with someone, essentially it's your own insecurities colouring
like projections.
Exactly. And you think that people are thinking this of you, and that's why you've taken what they've said to be about this or whatever. And it's that constant miscommunication between them, which I felt so relatable.
I really liked that.
And you never, I think we were talking about this off air, like you never can take a side because they're both right and wrong
in different ways. Yeah.
I thought that
was really
funny.
And there's so much miscommunication.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the troubles within their friendship actually are just underpinned by a small miscommunication.
Interestingly, though, when I was looking on Reddit, because I loved the book, but...
I loved it. It was one of my favourite books I read last year.
Same. But there was a big Reddit subreddit on why it was actually really bad.
Oh, interesting.
And one of the issues was, "I hate any sort of story that could be resolved with the characters simply communicating better."
Oh, I don't, because I think it's quite true of life.
Yeah, I do.
Like the amount of shit that's hit the fan because people just didn't properly communicate.
Exactly. No, I do. I think, I mean, it's interesting how much criticism it got on this Reddit thread. For instance, there's one of the themes is Sadie is in a toxic relationship with another gamer, and they...
I mean, that brings also age gaps into question, as he is her lecturer at university.
Yes, and he...
Power dynamics.
Exactly, and it's framed as quite violent BDSM that's not necessarily consensual on Sadie's part.
Yeah, it's like an abusive relationship for sure.
It is, but it never spells it out, and this Reddit person said that sexual abuse is underplayed as BDSM, which I actually thought was not necessarily fair, because I think...
No, I disagree. I think it makes it very clear that it's abuse. But it shows her experience at the time
in real time,
realizing it.
Exactly.
It's
that
with hindsight that she recognizes it as abuse.
And I think as well that I think you expect a certain level of emotional intelligence from the reader, and you don't necessarily need to spell everything out and be like, "And this is abuse, by the way." It's very clear that it is.
I think
is.
It's very clear. I actually disagree with that commenter.
I also did. And then there was another comment that said that Sam at one point is accused when his game hits the big time of cultural appropriation, because he's Korean, but Ichigo, his game, is influenced by Japanese art and culture. And so a lot of interviewers are like, "Is this not cultural appropriation?" And he has this big kind of rant about cultural appropriation, which I thought was quite interesting. I'm not going to read it all out now because it's very long, but he's basically saying that, like, what, so if I made a game that was influenced by Korean culture, that would be fine, even though actually I know nothing about Korean culture. I'm as much a stranger in that
to culture as to Japanese.
Exactly. So he's like, "But for some reason, that's fine for you, because on paper, I understand it."
There's a lot of commentary on art itself, isn't there? And that's what I really liked about the book. It's a kind of philosophical look at the creation of art. And Sam and Sadie each kind of represent a different version of success, in that they have different opinions on what is great.
Yes.
So for Sadie, art is great. For Sam, commercial success is great.
Yes.
And that's a very interesting dynamic that's explored, I think.
I also think that for Sam, he just wants to build games with his best friend. And Sadie has too many insecurities for that to be enough.
Yeah.
Because I think for him, he just wants to build with her. He wants to be working with her. Because actually also, you know, it comes to light that he's actually secretly in love with her.
Yes, which in a way makes it quite strange to talk about it as a book that focuses on platonic friendship, because it's actually also like an unrequited love tale.
Yeah, so for him, building games for Sadie or with Sadie is
his like love language.
Exactly. So it's much more meaningful to him.
Do you know, fun fact, it's actually Gabrielle Zevin's 10th novel.
Well, I actually find that really reassuring. So I'm like, thank God. Like,
it takes a while. It takes a while. Hit the big turn. Yeah. It's going to be made into a film by Paramount. I'm very excited for that.
Very interesting.
What I thought was fascinating, Zevin says this in an interview with Wired. And to me, this is what captured the brilliance of the tale in terms of technology, art, and how we've developed over the last kind of 40, 50 years. She said, we're very affected by tech, we know this, but there are very few places where you can visually see the evidence of this change as easily as video games. Look at Pong in the 70s, with the extreme minimalism of two lines and two dots, compared to where the book ends in about 2012. You get to games that have real cinema quality graphics and storytelling experience, something like The Last of Us. The Last of Us obviously being the iconic zombie game that spurned a HBO series, which features none other than Pedro Pascal and Bella Ramsey, one of my favourite things I watched last year. I'd never thought about games in that way, but they do perfectly capture and illustrate the technological change that's gone on, even just in mine and yours lifetime. I mean, what games were you playing as a kid? Were you on the PC?
I was on PC playing Tintin, Harry Potter, Animal Hospital.
I had like a Barbie riding school game, which I loved. And I also had, do you remember the Magic School Bus?
Yes.
It was like an
I don't remember it as a game.
Sorry, an educational. It was a program that also had a game that was educational, and you'd go on the Magic School Bus and it would shrink down and then you go inside the human body.
Oh,
but it was
wow.
So basic compared with, I remember my cousins had a Sega and they'd play Sonic the Hedgehog on it. Like, and now you have games that have all differing storylines and you can literally make A-B choices, which then dictate the trajectory of your character. We've got NPCs like,
yes,
non-player characters. You know, these like virtual worlds now are so complicated. I mean, I don't even game. It actually made me kind of want a game though. Did
yes,
it, make
it made me want a game. Yeah. Made me really want a game. So going back to the news story, do we think that what happens in a virtual world can be as important?
It's such a difficult one. I'm really torn on this because in one way, no. Like, you can see why haters are like, oh, just take the headset off. Why can't you run away? But I also think actually that does a disservice to the kind of principle here. And I can see why the police are taking it seriously.
I'm really glad they
are. Even though it does seem a bit like, okay, well, only 6% of rape cases in this country even go to trial. So how about we focus on real world rapes first? I could see that argument.
I can
but
see
actually,
that.
I think the real tipping point that we're at, and the reason that it matters now, is because at the end of the day, if we teach people that in these virtual worlds, like the metaverse, you can sexually assault people, what's the knock-on effect? Like, what? And also, obviously, this girl being a minor as well is definitely relevant.
Yes.
If we don't set very strong boundaries around this now, then what's like the evolution? Like, how do we stop this kind of behavior, A, tipping over into the real world? Especially now we're seeing such a rise in online misogyny, and that's having very real world consequences.
I remember even when Siri was like a new thing, everyone was like, if you shout or swear at Siri, then that's like really problematic because you're teaching children that it's okay to talk to normal, like real people like that.
Yeah. And this is the big issue with AI now. Yeah. Like, AI are our children. We must teach them kindly. That's Mo Gardart's whole thing.
Yeah.
AI is literally learning from us. Every chatbot, everything, it learns what we feed it. And so the future of AI as a kind of benevolent or malevolent force depends on what it takes in based on what we teach it now.
Such a good point. I also do think there are some people, say, who might spend the majority of their waking lives in the metaverse because it's better for them. They prefer it. So what is their reality then? If you spend 8 out of your 12 waking hours in the metaverse, and isn't that your primary reality, actually?
So I was reading an opinion piece by Nancy Jo Sales about this, and there's a very scary stat in there where she says that the next generation of kids will spend an estimated 10 years in virtual reality over the course of their lifetimes. So that'll be about 3 hours a day. That's what new research is suggesting. So yes, they're going to be there a lot of the time. I also think this recent rape is like a test for the UK's new online safety bill, which is only a year old set of laws that have been implemented to protect children and adults online.
Yes.
Some experts have expressed concerns that the bill doesn't go far enough, focusing more on the content users publish rather than their actions. But we'll see, I guess. I think this is a real tipping point in terms of how seriously we treat assault in the virtual world, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think it's really easy for people to be really snooty and be like, well, they shouldn't be so long in the metaverse and they should take the headset off. But like, the real world is so fucking depressing. Like, I have such empathy for kids who don't want to be in the current reality right now. Like, it's awful for a lot of kids. It's dark and depressing, and they might not have friends, and or they might be disabled or something, and therefore in the metaverse that's where they can truly exist in the way they want to. Like, we can't look down on that and just tell them to take it off.
But what is scary is that Meta have a notoriously like bad track record when it comes to protecting children and teenagers.
Yes.
So in 2021, a whistleblower, Frances Haugen, revealed that Facebook's own internal research showed how using Instagram, which obviously Meta own, adversely affects teen girls' confidence and body image. In October of last year, a bipartisan coalition of 33 attorneys general filed a lawsuit against Meta in California, alleging that Facebook and Instagram are responsible for a national youth mental health crisis. So we can't rely on the companies to safeguard.
No, absolutely Definitely not.
It needs to come from lawmakers.
So interestingly, I actually wrote about this in 2018 for the Sunday Times.
Wild.
It's really weird. This is the first time I've reread it.
How ahead of the curve you really were.
So very on theme. It's the title is called Sexism, Lies and Video Games, Being a Woman in the Virtual World.
I actually cannot believe you wrote that like five, 6 years ago.
Yes. And it's about cyber groping and rape threats. And it opens with me being cyber groped and how I'm using an Oculus Rift headset and moving around a room, and a male avatar dressed in a suit presses himself up against my avatar, and I jump back in shock.
So, but how? What did it feel like? How did you jump back in shock? Like, how did you know that another avatar was touching you?
Because you can see it. So you, you can. You, I guess you feel like you are your avatar, and it's come right up to you.
Got it.
So, no, you can't feel anything in terms of like your body, but like you are. Like your mind's eye, I guess, is your avatar.
You're like immersed into the avatar's reality, so you feel that you are inhabiting that.
So there's obviously the visual shock of someone just suddenly coming really close to you in the screen, but I suppose as an extension,
did you actually feel
violated? No, I didn't feel violated.
But had you put yourself in that scenario for this piece, so therefore your brain was obviously approaching it in a different way than if you were just like a metaverse user?
Exactly. But it was, the piece was in relation to the fact that April 2018, a survey, a 600-person survey, showed that almost 50% of women who engage in social virtual reality spaces are sexually harassed, from verbal abuse to groping your avatar by another avatar, being beaten by mundane objects, or having rubbish bins placed on your head.
I mean, Sadie in Tomorrow, Tomorrow, and Tomorrow captures a lot of this problem of extreme sexism in the video game world, doesn't she?
Yes, how hard
it is to actually be a female gamer.
I think what's really difficult, and I remember, I'm just scrolling down, I remember interviewing a lawyer for this, and they said, because without evidence, if it's virtual, there is no evidence. And in a criminal case, you need evidence. You need to prove the assault happened. And you can't really do that in the virtual world, because are there witnesses? Is there physical evidence? And obviously, without that, I don't know how they would be able to prosecute.
Surely, if it happened in the metaverse, there'd be some kind of screen recording type thing somewhere that could be used as evidence in this exact scenario that we're talking about, where the British police are investigating it.
Yes,
there must be evidence to even look into in
this
case.
And also, I think, obviously, this is 2018, so this was like 5 years ago. Obviously, it's got way more.
Technology has actually come ahead. Like, you weren't even, the metaverse wasn't even a whisper at that point. So you were very ahead of the curve.
I was. But I can imagine that, particularly if I don't game, so I actually don't know, but you use headsets, right? You can hear people's voices.
Where did you get the idea for the piece from?
It was, I saw the news of the study about how, it was this woman called Jessica Outlaw had published this study of how 50% of American women had been virtually harassed. So I spoke to many women who were using VR and headsets to be in the virtual reality, and they were all experiencing death and rape threats, and that it was rising. And I think the reason it's so immersive is that you're wearing a headset that allows you to hear real people's voices. You know, it's not just an avatar that's like moving around in silence.
Little fake friendly cartoon voice.
Yeah,
an actual person.
So someone is actually shouting rape and death threats at you, which, how is that actually different to someone shouting it in the street?
In the street, a stranger.
Yeah. And so one woman told me that a guy screamed down the microphone that he was going to rape me. He followed me from server to server. He then found her address on the electoral roll.
That's really scary.
And posted it repeatedly in the chat. And she had to go to the police.
Because, yeah, that has such real-world consequences. That isn't just one avatar bumping up against another avatar. Like, that is actual stalking.
That is, exactly. It's going from the virtual world to the real world.
Like, and I guess that's leaking. Why this whole thing is such a landmark moment. Because if we let this slide, then what does that say in terms of protecting the vulnerable moving forward, that we don't care?
Exactly.
Yeah, I think Tomorrow definitely captures the kind of casual violence that can be so endemic in gaming, isn't it? And it's actually part of Sam and Sadie's mission to make games that aren't shooters, as they call them. Because people do feel very funny about the impact that virtual violence in shooting games has had on the real world. And yes. I think perhaps that's why a lot of people are worried now. Even the Daily Mail, by the way, is pro-prosecution here with the virtual rape. And I would have thought that the Daily Mail would be, oh, it's all a load of woke time wastery. And actually, they had a senior police officer familiar with the case speak to them. And he even said, there's an emotional and psychological impact on the victim that's longer term than any physical injuries. And that's, as you said, the immersive quality of the metaverse experience makes it all the more difficult for a child, especially, to distinguish between what's real and what's make-believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, Eve, with the thing about our shooter games actually encouraging violence, I think maybe it was Evan herself who said it's not so much that, it's the problem with video games is it encourages like a hero mindset.
Yeah.
Which can be really toxic, particularly for men.
Yeah.
But to end on something more positive, what I found really moving about the way it talks about video games is the intimacy and vulnerability required to play with someone else and how it goes back to your inner child. There's a quote that says, maybe it was the willingness to play that hinted at a tender, eternally newborn part in all humans. Maybe it was the willingness to play that kept one from despair.
I love that. I love that she celebrates play.
Yeah, I love that because I sometimes I'm like, oh, I want kids because I just want to be able to go and like, be a kid myself.
Well, people
again.
Do say that that's one of the best things about having children is that you really engage with your inner child and you're really reminded of games you played and just things that you haven't even thought about for decades all come to the fore again.
Well, I do notice that when people are starting to fall in love, I think you often see it as they revert to being kids. They like play fight and they're really silly like with silly. Each other, and like there must be linked to the pure emotions of love and like the pure emotion of just being a kid and like wonder and like new experiences.
So I love that. It reminds me of whiling away many an hour on The Sims. Did you do that?
Yes, I did. Although
I was just with friends and you'd sit next to each other and take turns to design your characters in the house, because obviously only one person could play at a time.
And micro pets.
See, I didn't really have micro pets. The Sims was a really big one for me. Really big. I loved The Sims. People still play. Marlon actually bought it for me on Xbox to see if I'd like it, to try and get me back into gaming after I finished this book.
Yeah.
I was like, God, I've just got a real hunger to game. Wasn't the same on Xbox. I was like, I just cannot play this. If you are into gaming stories as well, I just want to give the Tetris movie a shout out.
Yes.
Because I watched it the other day and I have to say I very, very much enjoyed and didn't expect to. So it's on Apple TV and it stars Taron Egerton as the US businessman Henk Rogers, who basically discovered Tetris. Tetris was a game created by Russia in the 1980s. And the film is a biographical thriller that is based on the true events around the race to license and patent the video game around the world when it was like kind of owned by the Russian government. I mean, I'm butchering that. I would just say go away and watch it. It's really fascinating in terms of technology. I think in the same way that you've just mentioned, I was looking at best films of 2023. What haven't I seen yet? And it came up a lot. It's brilliant and also quite on brand for us because it looks at media power players, I suppose, as well. There's a very interesting portrayal of the Maxwells. So Robert Maxwell and his son, Kevin Maxwell, CEO of Mirrorsoft, which was their £1 billion media empire. So I'm sure you recognize that name.
From Ghislaine.
Yeah, father and brother of Ghislaine. Obviously, Robert Maxwell died under suspicious circumstances, having been disgraced.
Yes.
And done for fraud, among many other things. It's just fascinating, particularly, and this is a side note, but have you seen Ghislaine trying to like pink pussyhat her way out of jail?
Yes.
There's only one woman who's being held responsible for the crimes of men against women. And it's me. That's essentially what she's like trying to say. I'm like, absolutely not, hun, don't try it.
I mean, the whole leaked Epstein list was
wild.
Wild. Stephen Hawking.
I know. I'm sorry. We just must touch on that very quickly. What? Stephen Hawking's orgies with underage girls. I didn't know that much about him. And since seeing that, I've gone on a bit of a deep dive. He did actually leave his wife for his nurse, who was like 20-something years in his Junior and said that she was she had manic depression, and he claims that that was one of the things he liked about her. He wanted to like fix her. Like, it was all just very questionable.
Oh, classic toxic man.
Yeah, he clearly is a wrong'un.
Oh my God. Can everyone just bloody date their own age group for a second, please?
Also, and I do not want us to face legal action of any sort, but I am going to quickly touch upon Naomi Campbell being named.
Well, you know, there's been lots of things.
Yes, and I told you recently off air, didn't I, about a TikTok that I saw with a young male model who claimed on a podcast, if you want to see this, just look it up on TikTok, you'll find it, claims that he will not model until Naomi Campbell is held to account for her human trafficking. So this model alleges that Naomi Campbell is a very well-known human trafficker. And this was pre the Epstein scandal.
And she hasn't commented on it.
No.
She hasn't even denied
it. And he says anyone that has met Naomi will be able to attest to the fact that she has a dark energy.
So I remember meeting a group of models outside the NED once, and they were all very, very negative about Naomi.
And when you met her, did you feel a dark energy?
Yes, to be fair, I did. Not human trafficking kind, but certainly she was not a easy person to deal
with. Wasn't a ray of sunshine.
I did not.
And positivity.
No, but then again, neither was Skepta, and no one's accusing him of human trafficking. They were both difficult, but they were both difficult in the fact that they were both giving, I'm famous, get me out of here. I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. Just butchering the most famous quote ever. I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. It was just like two divas bouncing off against each other in the worst way.
Okay.
So yeah. I can't say I saw like a malevolent evil force. It was more like, oh, for fuck's sake.
Was it Naomi or Skepta who was concerned about possible Harvey Weinstein allusions if they were to be interviewed in their dressing gowns on the bed?
It was Skepta, to be fair, who had the foresight to think that considering Harvey Weinstein and his dressing gown was all over the papers, him being in a hotel room
in his dressing gown
was not a great look.
And Naomi, I'd say that was a sensible choice.
Yes, and Naomi was like, no, we need the dressing gown, because she had this whole vision for how she wanted to shoot his main's underwear brand. Also, it's his underwear. Surely he should have greater control. But as I've said before in the podcast, but I'll say it again, it was very interesting how controlling she was, to the point where he asked for a certain bottle of water and then Naomi went, no, give that one back. Junior will have Evian, and made the person whoever was handing out water change the kind of water he was about to drink.
Also, I think you've mentioned this on the podcast before, but it is perhaps my favorite celebrity anecdote of yours of all time. She didn't like the reception that she received when she entered the room, so she redid her entrance, did she not?
Yes. So firstly, when she first entered, I remember the Paul Solomons, who we've talked about on the podcast before, former ex of Kylie Minogue, being like...
creative director of GQ at the time.
Oh, sorry, God. Just treating him like a woman
Minogue.
There. Yeah. He was like, stand up. So he made me stand up to greet Naomi, which I think is a bit extra. Do you need to stand up to, like, when she's not even going to go and say hello to me anyway, and I'm nobody, but whatever. So we all had to stand up, and then she kicked off about the shoot and all these various things. And then because it had started on such a negative note, and she'd essentially just annihilated us all for like 10 minutes, she then was like, let me do that again, and left the room, shut the door, reopened it, and reintroduced herself and went, hi, I'm Naomi. Imagine if I replied, being like, hi, I'm Eleanor. No one was meant to reply to her. It was all for performance.
It's unhinged.
And also, it's like, we've been sitting, and you're like already 5 hours late. We unfortunately are so well acquainted with who you are. We would like you to actually leave.
Oh my goodness, that is a brilliant note to end on, I would say.
A brilliant note. Guys, we will recycle our anecdotes till we're red in the face, because that's exactly what Stephen Bartlett does, and it's working for him.
He does. It works very well for Stephen. True say.
Oh, yes.
I've heard more about his partner's breathwork than I have about his own business acumen.
I've heard more about his partner coming in whilst he's in the shower to ask about Banana Huel.
No shade to Huel. They are a former partner of this very podcast.
Stephen Bartlett follows me on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. We did DM him once and he did not reply.
He did not reply.
Damn it. He's actually my friend's boss. My friend's PR company was acquired by his company, Flight Story. My brother went to a marketing expo kind of thing recently, a digital marketing thing, and Stephen was there. And apparently it was quite culty in the way that we said Diary of a CEO Live was. My brother said that these people came into the room before Stephen entered and made everyone clap and go, Stephen! And then they were going, Stephen Bartlett, Stephen Bartlett. I'm serious. I was honestly said it was the craziest thing he's ever seen. And they were trying to drum up this like almost ecclesiastical support for Stephen so that he could walk in like head down, like, thank you, thank you, thank you, as he went up to the stage to sort of do his keynote.
Kath, when he came on with his fake prop briefcase on stage.
Oh my God. Dick Van Dyke over there.
Yeah. And also like getting, again, just like, what is it with men? Just like wielding their girlfriends as if they're just props. But yeah, his girlfriend having to like be part of the show.
Oh my God, when they like do heart confetti at the end and they're like, Stephen's life is complete now. He has real love in his life. And then they pan up to where his girlfriend sat. Yeah.
And even wheeling in his former business partner turned like drug addict to for like his like rehab story.
I've always found that a little bit questionable. Does Don McGregor mind you using his addiction story as the
part of your live show?
Yeah, like it's a bit much, but
you should get a cut of the
someone else's story there.
And it's kind of what we've been saying as part of the episode with Sick of Myself, the whole branding of trauma
yes.
for commercial gain.
And using real people as props.
Exactly.
As per Bianca Censori.
Everything fits so well together. It's like we planned
this
or something.
Guys, as always, please, please let us know your thoughts. Let us know what you'd like to talk about next time. We are going to cover Priscilla. We promise. We just need to both see it.
Well, we also need a break from paedophilia for a little bit.
We do. We thought we would just try and touch on some lighter topics this week and then somehow still ended up at human trafficking and virtual abuse.
Oh, my God.
So sorry about that. We will try and find more lighthearted topics. But, guys, the world's a damn dark place. Just is.
For something more cheery, go and watch Past Lives. Such a good romantic film that I think is going to win the Oscar. It's a Korean film. It's beautiful. Really, really beautiful. All about unfulfilled desire, but in the most like lovely way.
Ooh, love that.
Maybe we'll talk about it more when you see it and we can talk about our own unfulfilled desires.
If anyone would like a hangover style reco.
Oh yeah.
Most people probably are doing Dry Jan. So for anyone that saw the very standard Christmas film, Your Christmas or Mine, last year.
Oh, yeah.
Featuring Asa Butterfield and Lucien Laviscount. Laviscount? Oh, God.
Laviscount. Oh,
Laviscount,
I don't know.
You know what I mean. So there has, in fact, been a sequel, Your Christmas or Mine 2, where the couple spend their second Christmas as a couple alongside the original cast, and it is beautifully rubbish.
Well, and you watched that in January, did you?
I did.
Well, that is deeply...
I didn't know it had come out yet until like a few days ago.
Well, Cathers, whatever floats your boat, if you want to keep the festive period plodding
alive.
Along.
I also, over the weekend, paid £3.25 to watch the film Andre about the seal on Amazon because that was one of my childhood favourites. But you know when you rewatch a film that you really loved when you were a kid and you're like, oh.
Yes.
I'm perceiving this quite differently now.
Yes, I had that rewatching Fawlty Towers. Definitely very not
hit
okay.
A bit differently this time.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's actually really problematic. However, that's why I won't rewatch Lassie because I don't want to ruin that for me.
Next on the list, Marlon wants me to watch Flipper with him.
That is sweet.
It'll probably be terrible. Free Willy.
There's a whole
range of
aquamarine
sea mammal films.
Yes.
Right, that's quite enough.
Sorry, yeah.
Guys, rate, review, and subscribe. Can you let us know if there's anything you would like us to debrief on? We are hard at work on all the ones we've already promised, so do not you worry.
Yeah.
Anything new that we've missed, let us know.
I would also like to issue a public apology.
Go on, are you going to do it? We're going to do it.
It's a mea culpa, guys. A few weeks ago, I said something on the podcast that turned out to be misinformation and it has
spreading lies
troubled many of you. And
it
we
has.
Have received many DMs. And I just want to say I'm really sorry that I said that Belle Powley was in Angus Songs and Full Frontal Snogging because she wasn't.
She wasn't.
It was a lapse in lucidity. I'll do better.
The name of the actress that was in Angus Songs and Full Frontal Snogging was, in fact, Georgia Groom, who's an English actress, best known, of course, for Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging. I'm sure it was called Full Frontal Snogging,
I
the book.
They must
have toned it down.
Was that another lie I spread?
I think they toned down the name for the film, but it was definitely Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging. I have just seen a wild fact that I did not know.
Are you sure?
Rupert Grint is her partner, i.e. Ron Weasley.
Oh, wow.
Yes. An unexpected acting dynasty starting there.
Cathers, I think it's always been Angus Songs and Perfect Snogging.
No, it was definitely Full Frontal Snogging. It was.
Because, I mean, I would like to believe you because I said it was Full Frontal, but I'm looking
at... No, it was... We were right, it was.
Was it? How do you know?
Yes, Angus, I just looked it up. It was the 99. Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging is a 1999 young adult novel by English author Louise Renenson.
What's wrong with saying Full Frontal Snogging?
I guess Full Frontal sounds a bit like risque.
But it's saying it's perfect snogging is not faithful to the ethos of the book.
Well, this will be why. Because Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging was banned on several occasions in American schools, often challenged by parents due to its sexual content and its main character talking back to her parents.
Oh.
God's sake.
To be fair, my dad banned me from reading Princess Diaries.
Really?
Yeah.
But that was so innocent.
My dad was the headmaster, so...
Yeah. Still, why?
What? Oh, because there was snogging on the first page.
Oh, was there?
Yeah.
Right. Oh, I forgot about the snogging. My parents were not like in touch with what was actually happening in YA fiction, so I could just read whatever I liked.
That's good. Probably a better person for it because it's character building.
Maybe.
Anyway, so I am really sorry about that.
I think that is a very...
noble apology.
Exactly that. Thank you, honey.
It's good
much appreciated.
To fess up.
It is. We got it wrong. We're sorry. We'll do better.
Bye for now.
See you next week, guys.